Where You Want to Be, a Stargate Atlantis fanfiction by Semival. The Cataldi have a plant the biochemists are convinced they can use to synthesize high-strength narcotics, something close enough to the opioid family. It's a pretty little weed with pale blue flowers, growing wild all over GTW-441. The Cataldi are more than happy to give it to them, nothing required in return. There's just the matter of the welcoming and friendship ceremony. No sooner are the words out of the mouth of the Cataldi magistrate than Rodney can be heard muttering, "Of course, a ceremony. I'm sure it won't involve anything humiliating or painful or morally objectionable." Taylor talks over him, taking the magistrate to one side to politely inquire as to the specifics of the ritual, but there's a tension in her voice. Ronan begins idly playing with the knife on his belt loop. They've all grown wary, understandably so, of alien initiation rites. Not always as innocuous as advertised. John just keeps smiling, one hand on his P90, wondering what the Cataldi will ask them to do, and whether or not it will be too much to ask. On TL1-398, he had to sacrifice something that resembled a goat, but with sweet, sad eyes that he still can't forget. But on PRQ-943, the Mapathans had just held their hands and chanted for an hour, then given them bushels of a green, nutty-tasting grain in exchange for the repair of some of their steam-powered farming equipment. On LXW-122, Ronan had shot a flaming arrow through a hoop. For the Bernai, Taylor had sat still while something like a 5-inch scarab walked the length of her body. John had had to look away before it even made it past her knee. For the promise of a leaf that could be brewed into a mild stimulant, they had each of them donated a teaspoon of blood, taken from the left palm and dripped onto the yellow earth. "Believe me, Colonel, I'd probably be willing to part with a lesser-used toe for the chance of something stronger than a Thosian tea." But the Ferulians had demanded a display of leadership that involved beating his people. On RVR-355, they had wanted children, or the chance to make them. The Pritam had a nasty game of Russian roulette with a poison arrow. The Dandar required a marriage alliance. The Jab had wanted to keep Rodney for a month. They had walked away, or, when necessary, run away, from those planets, from the chance of salt, industrial-grade alcohol, unrefined Naquada ore. John liked to think that there were certain things he wouldn't do, but he wasn't so naive that he didn't recognise that the stakes kept changing, and the bar kept lowering. They had made a mistake. He had made a mistake. On NCG-374. Atlantis had a problem with a growing collection of burnt-out control crystals, and the Tulai had a district of ancient ruins they were willing to let them scavenge. Everyone figured Ronan would have no trouble proving his fortitude in what sounded like an Iron Man obstacle course. And, as predicted, he'd breezed through the running, the climbing, the shooting, the swimming, and the spelunking. But it turned out the finale was a dose of hallucinogens that had him crying and screaming on the ground, reliving the coming of the Wraith and the last days of Zadida. So all in all, John was relieved to hear the Cataldi's terms. "How many participants?" he asked over the sound of Rodney's enraged spluttering. "At least two," Taylor replied. "And how does it have to be done?" "There are no specific requirements, but the minister was adamant that it be mutual." "And that's it?" asks John. "Just on the ground? They don't want to do anything with it afterwards? Like try to get someone pregnant?" "No," Taylor reassures him immediately. "I made sure of that." "Okay, looks like we're good to go. Taylor, Ronan, you know what to do. Rodney, you're up." McKay's low-grade rant suddenly bursts into surround sound. "You can't be serious. You're not seriously going to spill your seed." "Nope," John replies, grinning. "I think you're going to spill it for me." He's pretty relaxed now. This won't even be that hard. They need those drugs, have needed those drugs, and the fact that he can get them, can come back from a mission successful, keep them afloat a little longer, means he's having a good day. Rodney's red-faced and sweating. "This is too much," he's shouting. "Of all the indignities I have been subjected to in two galaxies, this really takes the cake. Forget it. I refuse. I refuse to engage in public sex." He crosses his arms over his chest and sticks his chin out. John's kind of disappointed. As rants go, it's remarkably short of verbiage and ad hominem attacks. Now, Rodney, it's your turn, fair and square." They don't really keep a one-to-one tally, but there are unspoken rules about these things. It's always John's job to complete the ritual, unless he can't, or he's obviously unsuited for it. When it's more than one person, it's Taylor for agility or precision, Ronan for strength or endurance, and Rodney for anything potentially embarrassing, something you really wouldn't feel comfortable asking the leader of a people or the last member of an entire civilization to perform. Rodney's up, and everyone knows it, including him. "Look," he says, dropping his voice and changing tactics, "this is just not something I can do. I'm not like you." "Right, because John whips it out for alien dignitaries all the time." "Relax, Rodney, it'll be fine," John tells him, clapping a hand on his shoulder. "Just close your eyes and think of Atlantis." They leave their weapons and tack vests with Ronan and Taylor, but walk into the stone circle with the rest of their clothes on. Rodney's gone quiet, which, in John's experience, is never a good sign. And as he takes a look around at the throngs of expectant faces, men, women, children, Christ, people have brought their kids to see this, he starts to feel a little less confident about the whole thing himself. Rodney looks like he's ready to bolt, so John puts a steadying hand on his arm. "Look," he says, as the headman begins banging a large gong. "It'll be fine, just pretend you're alone. Close your eyes, there's nobody watching." Rodney looks like he desperately wants to accept this reassurance, but his superior intellect and native realism just won't let him. "It's going to be kind of hard to pretend I'm by myself," he hisses, red now all the way from his ears to his throat, "with your hand on my dick." "Nah, I've got an idea," says John. He has to act now, before McKay works himself into a fully fledged anxiety attack. With a calmness he doesn't completely feel, he reaches out to unzip Rodney's pants. Rodney jerks, snaps his eyes down to John's hand, and then clamps them shut. John just holds Rodney loosely in his hand, unzipping himself and guiding Rodney's hand to his own fly. "Here's what we're going to do," he whispers, as Rodney hesitantly wraps his fingers around John's cock. "You're going to jerk me off. Pretend that you're doing it to yourself. Do what you like, whatever gets you off fastest. Whatever you do to me, I'm going to do to you. It'll be just like your own hand on your own dick, okay? There's no one else here, just..." "Yes, yes, I get it. Shut up now," snaps Rodney. And just like that, he's off, pressing his thumb underneath the shaft at the base, cupping the head of John's cock in his wide palm. John's caught off guard, and it takes him a second to catch up, rushing to do the same to Rodney. Rodney's still got his eyes squeezed shut, but John doesn't have that luxury. He needs to know what's going on around them. He needs to make sure they're still safe. As a result, he can see Rodney's face, tensed in concentration, see Rodney's hand on his dick, his own hand on Rodney's dick as he copies the motion a beat later. And while this may be the way Rodney jerks himself off all the time, for John, it's completely new. God, it's been so long since he's had someone else's hand on his cock. He's getting hard already. He can see it reflected immediately on Rodney's face, a smug curling up at the corner of his mouth. And there's no way he's coming before Rodney, so he steps it up, doing everything Rodney's doing to him, only harder, faster, with an extra twist on the end. Rodney's looking serious now, pulling out all the stops as he swipes his thumb across the moisture at the tip and slicks it down the length of John's dick, pressing hard against the vein as his fingers travel back up. He's getting close, and so is Rodney. So he's probably not thinking too clearly about their deal, or their audience, or how he might be really, really screwing himself here, when he slides his other hand into Rodney's pants, giving his balls a quick fondle, then pressing his fingers into the strip of skin just beyond. Rodney's eyes fly open in surprise, and then he's coming, jerking in John's other hand. John follows him over, staring straight into Rodney's eyes as he spills, onto Rodney's hand, his pants, the ground between them. A polite smattering of applause follows. Rodney jumps and snatches his hand back, as if he really had managed to forget what they were doing here, and is only now realising that he and his team leader just masturbated each other in the town square in front of the entire population of an alien city. Thankfully, the Cataldi don't ask them to stick around after the main event, seeing them off to Atlantis with their warm wishes and 10 baskets full of blue flowers. He and Rodney are fine. It's no big deal, and they never speak of it again. It's not like he'd ever thought about Rodney that way before. It was just that it had been so long. Now he knows what Rodney looks like when he comes. And if he tries out Rodney's moves late at night in his own quarters, it's just so it will feel like it's not his own hand on his own cock. And anyway, it's fine. He's used to not getting what he wants. "I can't believe you initiated that sequence," Rodney's still muttering, kicking John in the shin as he crawls over him to reach the access panel. "Hey, I didn't know it was going to go ballistic. Besides, you told me to turn it on." "Yeah, turn it on, not set to pulverise," Rodney grumbles. The two of them are stuffed in a maintenance duct off the secondary lab, hiding from ancient artifact number 4325.6B. It had looked innocent enough, a pale pink sphere roughly the size of a ping-pong ball. And after he turned it on, it had seemed to want John to play with it, suggesting eagerly that he initiate a special sequence of mental switches. It had grown steadily warmer in his hand as he did so, until it levitated right up to eye level. "Rodney, hey, this is pretty cool. Take a look at..." and started slamming itself around the room with such force it shattered an experimental circuit of microcrystals Rodriguez had left out on one of the lab benches, arcing up and into the back wall, where it ricocheted off with a loud thump, sending a shower of sparks as it barreled into an open laptop on the other side of the room. "Holy crap!" yelled John, diving underneath the nearest table and pulling Rodney down after him, who flailed for his own laptop first, screaming, "Turn it off! Turn it off!" as he crashed into John, banging him against the table leg. "I tried that!" John yells back. "Well, try harder!" And even though McKay's an ass about it, he's usually right, so John tries again, squeezing his eyes shut and screaming, "Off! Off! Right now! I mean it!" in his head. But the Super Ball cheerfully points out that it has no override protocol and continues zipping around the room at an increasingly frenetic pace. After the fourth time it pounds against the top, or the edge of their table, off one of the legs, John starts to think it might be out to get them. "Oh my God," says Rodney, "it's aiming for us. What did you do to piss it off?" But he doesn't wait for John's sarcastic retort. "Listen, we can't stay here. I need an access panel that will give me environmental controls. There's one in that maintenance duct." And he points at the far side of the room, into a space between two unmovable work tables, in an area depressingly free of natural cover. Which is how John ends up playing baseball with a three-legged stool as Rodney frantically works to remove the duct cover. The ball is small and fast and hard to see in the strobing light of the automatic quarantine, and it almost takes him out at the knees before he manages to sideswipe it with the business end of the stool, sending it into the wall 3 feet away, where it leaves an impressive dent before flying across the room again. "Hurry up, McKay!" Almost done, Rodney huffs. Whack. Double to right. Gah. Thump. Foul tip. John's just sent a triple to centre when Rodney yells, "Done!" which is just as well, because the last hit splintered the cheap laminate on his makeshift bat. John throws himself into the duct behind Rodney, and when he reaches behind to pull the cover back over the entrance, the ping-pong ball from hell gets him right in the wrist. Hard. And it fucking hurts like a motherfucker. "What happened? What's wrong? Did it get you?" asks Rodney as John falls back into Rodney's legs, cradling his wrist, which he's sure is broken, with his good hand. Let me, says Rodney, making motions as though he wants to touch John's hand. He pulls it protectively closer to his chest. No, just figure out how to shut that damn thing down. Right, okay, says Rodney, and then, I need to get at that panel, right? And he points to an indentation behind John's head. John groans, but shifts to press himself to the other side of the narrow space, and they somehow end up, with much jostling and swearing, with John stretched out with his bad hand up over his head, resting on his elbow and hip, Rodney in front of him, facing away towards the panel. Rodney's hot-wiring his data pad into a mess of ancient circuitry, while John finally gets on his radio and assures Elizabeth that they've got it under control and know there is not an invading wraith or a flesh-eating nanite on the loose in Lab 2, just, you know, a rabid ping-pong ball. Rodney interrupts by yelling into John's radio from 4 inches away. We'll tell you all about it later, Elizabeth. Don't let Raddick do anything. He's locked out and he'll only close the system down tighter. If you leave us alone, we'll be done in 10 minutes. Goodbye. I have a piece of cable in my right lower pants pocket and I need you to get it for me, he tells John. Rodney's right leg is wedged against John's and there isn't a whole lot of clearance. He has to feel along Rodney's leg for a minute in search of his pocket, scraping his knuckles against the smooth metal of the duct wall in the process. And when he finds it, it turns out to be easier to just rip it open than get his hand inside. Damn it, Shepherd, that was my last decent pair of pants. I'll buy you some new ones. Maybe from the Minjarans next time they visit. Which is a funny joke, because the Minjarans wear ridiculous knee-length garments that look a lot like lederhosen. Ha ha, says Rodney. But John's got the 3-inch piece of cable now, and he inchworms it up Rodney's leg. Rodney wriggles his arm down to meet him halfway, elbowing John in the solar plexus, and then wriggles it back once he's got the connector, elbowing John in the ribcage. John lets his hand fall back against his own leg, but all of a sudden he's hit with the sense memory of groping Rodney's entire right thigh. and he's newly aware that he and Rodney are touching in more than 7 places, and Jesus Christ, what is wrong with him? He can hear the Super Bowl banging around outside, thumping onto the metal duck cover and the surrounding wall. He's really starting to feel the burn from his broken wrist, hot flares of pain shooting up his forearm. The air in the narrow shaft is musty and hot. He's sweating through his uniform shirt, and his left foot is going numb. And yet, somehow, none of that seems to matter. Rodney brushes against him when he connects the cables, when he navigates the data pad, when he breathes. He's sweating too, and John can smell him. And mostly, John's body can't seem to forget that he's held Rodney's cock in his hand, that he's seen Rodney come. "What the hell is that thing, anyway?" he tries. Rodney grunts dismissively. "Practical joke? Booby trap? Party favour for disobedient children? Martial arts training drone? Extreme sport paraphernalia? Let me tell you, Colonel, the more I learn about the ancients, the less I understand about the ancients." "Aha, got it." And John has a moment of relief that lasts until Rodney says, "Now we just have to wait 7 minutes for the fire-retardant foam to sufficiently dampen its propulsion system." It turns out 7 minutes is a really long time when you basically have Rodney McKay's ass pressed against your dick. And John's pretty sure he never used to be this sloppy. Lord knows he's not exactly a paragon of self-restraint, but he's been in the military a long time, and you might jerk a guy off after hours, but you sure as hell never thought about licking the back of his neck, on or off the clock. He really needs to get his shit together here before he fucks things up, because Rodney might be a little slow in figuring stuff out when he's not dealing with a machine or a well-behaved physical system, but even he's eventually going to notice. "Oh, you have got to be kidding me!" John lets his head thunk back hollowly against the metal wall. "Rodney, look, I mean, my God, I knew you were an adrenaline junkie, but this is ridiculous. For God's sakes, your wrist must be broken. Are you really that into the thrill of danger? Unless it's the pain you get off on. Actually, that might... I am not into pain." "Okay, fine. It's not like it would really be much crazier." Rodney shakes his head in disbelief, digging his shoulder into John's collarbone. "I mean, when..." "McKay, we are not going to talk about it." "Fine, fine, I just think..." "If you do not shut up right now," John hisses, "I will kill you with my bare hands." They spend the rest of their 7 minutes in silence. Then John is treated to a whole body grind as Rodney extricates himself from the metal tube. He gives himself just a minute to pretend all this never happened, and then, with as much dignity as he can muster, he crawls out into a foot and a half sea of bright blue safety foam. It happens again on RTW-417, a week after John's cast comes off. They're hiding from the Praxis, armed with primitive but deadly projectiles and high on crazy god juice. He and Rodney have tumbled into a shallow ditch, this time front to front, but thankfully this is a situation when it's actually plausible to claim that there's a gun in his pocket, or a hand grenade, a holster buckle, knife handle, life signs detector. And he's pretty sure Rodney doesn't even notice. When they get back from the negotiations on TGT-465, there are baskets of penis-shaped fruit all over the mess. The verisimilitude is unnerving. They're 6 to 8 inches in length, slightly curved, a mottlish brownish colour, with suggestively bulbous ends. Some even have an indentation at the tip. Carson is completely impervious to the endless jokes, pranks and food fights, insisting that Tarat fruit become an expedition staple. Apparently it's a rich source of vitamins A, C, E and B12, as well as magnesium, potassium, zinc and calcium. And that's when John knows the Pegasus Galaxy hates him. The first few sips of Andan liqueur go down smooth, so he keeps drinking it. They're here to celebrate their successful trade negotiations, cheese and honey for chemical fertilisers. The Andans are decent people, just trying to eke out a living in the shadow of the Wraith. They didn't even make his team do anything that crazy on first contact, nothing that John would grow to regret later. So he feels pretty good about things, pretty relaxed, or as relaxed as he ever gets off-world. Taylor's wearing a floor-length skirt, slit up both sides, and a red lace-up top with actual sleeves for the event. And she looks gorgeous. She's making the rounds, talking and smiling. The Andans love her, and John figures she makes up for Ronan silently lurking against the back wall and Rodney stuffing his face at the buffet and talking with his mouth full. He feels a sudden wave of affection sweep over him, followed by an almost giddy rush of joy. This is a good day. Hell, this is a great day. He feels like he's got everything he could need, everything he could want. At this moment, there's nothing to worry about. And that's when he knows something's wrong. He makes his way over to Taylor, gripping his glass tightly, but he can't quite stop himself from taking another drink from it. It's good stuff. Taylor, he calls once he's within range. She turns and automatically mirrors his smile with one of her own. Taylor, he says again, gathering her into a hug, burying his face in her sweet-smelling hair. She's surprised, he can tell, but recovers quickly, bringing her arms up around his back. God, that's what he loves about her. She's never at a loss, always lands on her feet, always knows what to do next. Colonel Shepherd? She asks gently as the hug goes on and on. Taylor! He leans down to whisper in her ear, brushing her hair back so she'll be sure to hear him. No one else can drink this. He draws back to show her the purple liquid in the bottom of his cup, but can't resist taking another sip of it. She looks puzzled at first, then realization dawns. He knew he could count on Taylor. And she reaches out to snatch the cup out of his hand. Come with me, Colonel, she says, grasping his hand. John promptly twines his fingers with hers and happily follows her through the crowd. What is this? Taylor's suddenly demanding of a robed Andon councillor. They've somehow acquired Ronan and Rodney in their journey across the room, and John feels pleased that the whole team is together now. The councillor's clearly taken aback by Taylor's accusatory tone. It's palat, he explains, a delicacy distilled here in the capital. We traditionally drink it at events such as this, and offer it to our cherished guests. It has a mild calmative effect that most find very enjoyable. At this, Rodney snorts loudly. The minister looks upset. Is there a problem? He asks. Colonel Shepherd, are you not well? I'm great, says John. He likes this guy. He doesn't want him to feel bad. Oh my God, says Rodney, spinning John to look into his eyes, pressing his finger to John's wrist. You drugged him! You totally drugged him! Ronan is suddenly looming in John's peripheral vision. The Andon minister raises his hands placatingly. Perhaps the colonel is having an unusually strong reaction. I assure you, the drink is completely safe, and the effects are very temporary. He appeals to Taylor. No harm was meant. Taylor seems to accept this explanation, which is good, because it'd be a shame if Ronan had to pound on the guy. He's a nice guy, just doing his job. I can carry him, Ronan's saying, when John tunes back into the conversation. No, no, he says. It's late and dark. We don't know the terrain. We'll stay here. Report the situation to Atlantis and monitor my condition. Please, you don't get a vote, snaps Rodney. Hey, that was kind of mean. I agree with Colonel Shepherd, says Taylor. We will remain for now, but if your condition worsens, we will call for medical assistance. It's nice just sitting between Ronan and Rodney on a low bench against the back wall while Taylor resumes her diplomatic rounds. He still feels good, but Ronan's tense and Rodney's jittery. I wish you guys could have had some of that, he sighs. It's really great. Sure, Rodney says, because if it does this to you, it'd probably make me lose all motor control. Right, Rodney's allergies. He totally forgot about that. Rodney, he says urgently, you probably shouldn't have any of that.
No, Colonel, I wasn't planning on it.
Good, that's good, he says, smiling because he feels relieved and he feels happy. But Rodney doesn't smile back at him. Actually, he looks a little sad. Rodney, he leans in. Don't be sad. He tries to poke the corner of Rodney's mouth up instead of down. For God's sake, Colonel, Rodney shouts, batting his hand away. I'm fine, I'm not sad. Keep your hands to yourself.
Ronan chuckles, deep and raspy,
and John turns to him, pleased. Ronan doesn't laugh very much. Hey, big guy, he says, and Ronan smiles back at him, which is almost the best thing that's ever happened to John. He turns back excitedly. Rodney, look, look!
Oh my God, says Rodney.
That's terrifying, put that away. But John can tell he's joking. Ronan cuffs him on the back of the head, and Rodney yelps and slides down the bench away from him, which actually puts him in the perfect position for John to lie down and rest his head on Rodney's thigh. You should smile more often, he says, looking up at Rodney's flushed face. And the next bit he doesn't remember that well, because he was starting to drift into sleep. But even though he later tries very hard to convince himself he didn't, he's pretty sure that he did, in fact, say, "Because you have beautiful eyes," right before he closes his own. The effects of the palat wear off after a few hours, and all he's got is a mild hangover. Thankfully, neither Rona nor Taylor mentions the incident again. And Rodney, in a move of stunning and unexpected tact, lets the inappropriate compliment go, not even teasing him about the episode at all, except the first time he's down in the lab after the mission, when Rodney looks up from his monitor to say, "No more Mary Poppins syndrome, then?"
"No," says John. "I've given up the inappropriate sunny outlook on life."
"Well, thank God for that," Rodney replies, and goes back to his simulations.
John doesn't get inappropriately aroused on XLL-926, but that's probably because Rodney's not actually there for most of the mission. They've started assigning more scientists for fieldwork, and it's SGA-1's turn to take a training run. Dr. Hansen is tall and fresh-faced, with thick curly brown hair framing wide green eyes. And he doesn't do a thing for John. He's a geologist originally, but, like everyone else, he's been cross-trained in ancient tech and basic electrical engineering. He's been on Atlantis 2 years, but he still projects a kind of youthful enthusiasm that John immediately distrusts. Either this guy's been living under a rock his whole life, or he's the kind of stupid that's incurable. Both of which will get you killed before lunchtime in the Pegasus Galaxy. But they're on a milk run to an uninhabited planet to recon some ancient outposts that have already been scanned once on flyby. The sun's shining and Hansen is gamely trudging along under the 50-pound pack they make all the newbies carry. So John deliberately quashes his misgivings and tries to give the guy a chance. 2 hours later, he has occasion to sincerely and devoutly regret that decision. Hansen has managed to activate one of the control panels in the southern wall, no idea how, and when the entire wall starts glowing right before flaring into a focused column of light, Ronan pushes Hansen out of the way, getting caught and pinned like a fly in amber, arms outstretched, feet 4 inches off the ground. Hansen's befuddled and agape for a second before he offers tentatively, "I'm pretty sure I can figure out how to turn it off."
"No," John snaps.
The console is doing something. He doesn't know what. Cycling through some startup protocol, and God only knows what will happen if they disrupt it. He puts his hand against the pulsing panel and feels a scroll of meaningless data. Strings of bits followed by checksum integers, and then interrupt, quantum anomaly. More scrolling data. Interrupt, quantum anomaly. Interrupt, interrupt, quantum anomaly.
Oh, fuck.
"Taylor, you're going back to Atlantis. Get McKay. I don't want Zelenka or Simpson or anyone else. Get McKay and tell him we've got a quantum scanner and he needs to come and get Ronan the fuck out of it." Without a word, Taylor sheds her pack, her P90 and her bulky tack vest and sets off at a run for the gate. Hansen decides to take this opportunity to turn John's anger into blind fury. He's pulling out a data pad from his pack, along with a connector crystal, saying, "There's a protocol for these kinds of devices. It's probably..." John gets right up in his face. "Dr. Hansen, you're not touching anything else. What you're going to do is stand perfectly still in the centre of this room until I tell you otherwise. Do I make myself clear?" Hansen actually looks like he might protest for a minute. And John really can't believe this guy. Obviously, he's never had any direct contact with McKay whatsoever. But, thankfully, some sort of half-dormant self-preservation instinct kicks in and Hansen shuts his mouth and follows the order. By the time Rodney arrives, 42 minutes and 25 seconds later, the proliferating quantum anomaly warnings are starting to make John want to claw his eyes out. "You," Rodney barks, pointing a peremptory finger at Hansen. "What did you do?" Hansen jerks and stutters, finally cowed into trepidation by the 43 minutes of utter silence they've spent together.
Nothing. It just came on."
"Did you touch something? Trip over something? Think something?" Rodney rattles off, pulling out his laptop and taking a handheld scanner from Taylor.
"No, I don't know," says Hansen miserably.
"Okay, you're completely useless. Shut up now. Don't move and don't breathe. Colonel?" 45 minutes, 40 seconds, 126 scans. It's stalled on some sort of initialization sequence. Ronnie's skirting the blue beam of light with his handheld. "Taylor, I need the blue and the yellow." And Taylor unfolds the padded carrying case and hands Rodney the two crystals. They're all silent for about 10 minutes, just watching as Rodney scans, then nudges a connection, scans, nudges, until his two crystals have nestled in the gigantic 122 crystal array, and data is scrolling across his laptop screen. "The good news," he says, "is that the error is preventing the scan from completing and sucking Ronan into memory storage." And here he waves a hand at the bank of ominously dark, burnt-out crystals that make John flinch. The bad news, Rodney continues, is that the error is preventing the scan from completing, keeping Ronan in suspended animation with an open I.O. line accumulating garbage code.
So we just shut it down, says John, even though he knows that won't work.
Yes, Colonel, says Rodney, typing one-handed as he roots around in the pack. We shut it down, because we have every confidence that a forced quit will be gracefully handled by the fail-safe protocols meticulously coded into the ancient 10,000-year-old science fair projects.
Right.
So we get it to complete the scan, says John.
No, says Rodney, because we don't have enough storage.
Just the first stage?
Yes, except for the fact it can't scan Ronan at all. Because, oh fuck, 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 he doesn't have the gene.
Bingo, says Rodney.
John approaches the blue beam warily as Rodney wraps up his last diagnostics. He's written 50 lines of code that should allow them to add genetic material mid-scan, namely John's genetic material, and route the preliminary output to a brand new orange storage crystal, and then shut down the whole process. Rodney says it's much riskier to try and put the material back. He says it's less than 1/1,000,000,000 of John's total information content, and redundant besides. And John believes him, but that doesn't stop the instinctual feeling of uneasiness as he approaches the scanning beam.
Let's go, Colonel. I haven't got all day, Rodney huffs.
But John quirks a quelling eyebrow. He just watched Rodney check and recheck his code 11 times, measure the crystal's tolerance 3 times, and ping the temporary handshake connection no fewer than 5 times. He glances over at Hansen, who has newly absorbed the knowledge of how utterly out of his depth he is. Which is a good lesson for the Pegasus Galaxy. And maybe this guy's also figured out exactly how important Rodney McKay is to the continued existence of the Atlantis expedition. At least as important as he says he is, plus a little bit more. And it's just John's rotten luck that he really does have beautiful eyes. Quirking a wry grin Hansen's way, John steps into the beam of light. John spends all dinner flirting shamelessly with the Padawan's sister. She's young and pretty and flattered by the attention, and John figures he could use the practice. He pours her wine and offers her food from his plate and doesn't look at Rodney across the table, where he's talking the ear off the Padawan's second cousin twice removed. The food is good, the company is non-hostile, and he's 2 weeks out from an epic clusterfuck on LPP-932, where the natives thought they were Genai invaders, and the Marines thought the natives were Genai agents, and 10 men were wounded, 1 killed, with Lopez still in recovery. John can't look at Rodney right now, because he doesn't trust himself. He's too close to crisis, everything he wants too close to the surface. And if he can't, for some reason, remember all the reasons he can't have what he wants, or even how Dr. Rodney McKay became the thing he wants, he can at least remember the rules. Instead, he laughs at something Marcher is saying, touches her wrist, leans in to whisper in her ear. He makes it through 5 courses, dessert, and a hot, sweet beverage that way. And Marcher walks him back through the residential complex, leaning on his arm, telling him about the Padawan estates, offering to show him her wing of the palace. John extricates himself at the next branching hallway, expressing his regret, offering his excuses. She's visibly disappointed when he leaves her in the corridor, and it makes John feel a little more in the groove, a little more put together. He opens the door to their shared suite, and Rodney looks up from his laptop, clearly surprised to see him. And John looks back at him, lets himself really look for a second, before he goes to his own bedroom and closes the door. They're all gathered in the mess for Atlantis's non-denominational winter holiday party. It's the one big public event of the year, attendance is mandatory and the place is buzzing. They've got alcohol, the mellow fruity stuff from the mainland, and a DJ spinning a scavenged collection that hits new heights of eclecticism, cycling between Motown, great 80s hits, hip-hop and Latin dance. A contingent of Athosians is there, as well as a handful of Teretics, the newest refugees from PLN-438, and a visiting delegation of Rutulians. People have really gone all out, Sunday best as far as the eye can see. The Atlantis personnel are in their most presentable uniforms, the ones with the fewest patches and the most remaining buttons, except for those of them whose high collateral damage lifestyles have already forced them to go native. John himself is wearing a dark purple Athosian overshirt and leather pants, but he takes a certain pride in seeing the faded khakis, red and blues, flashing in the crowd, marking the people of the Atlantis expedition, marking his people. He's on his third drink by the time physics and engineering shows up. Predictably, they have to be dragged from the labs,
but someone sent them home to change first, and Rodney's wearing a sapphire blue Pendragon great shirt that looks really, really good on him. Don lets himself enjoy the view for a few seconds before he turns his gaze back to the unruly dance floor. He dances with Elizabeth to some pulsing electronica, and with Taylor to the Four Tops. He gets pulled into a sweaty, possibly non-uniform compliant conga line of Marines, and braves one turn around the dance floor before escaping to the self-service bar, where he services himself with another drink. A petite, dark-haired Athosian girl shyly asks him to dance. He thinks her name is Rena, and she can't be more than 22 years old. He puts one hand at her waist and the other safely extended to her shoulder and sways her through Every Breath You Take until it looks like she's taking the lyrics a little too much to heart, at which point he bows his forehead to hers, thanks her for the dance, and retreats to the safety of the upper balcony with his fifth drink. It's chilly out here, but this side of the planet never really gets that cold, so it's a pleasant change from the overheated air of the mess hall. He figures he's put in the FaceTime, that he can spend the rest of his designated party hours out here before heading back to his quarters. When the door whooshes open behind him, he's really only hoping it's not the Rutulian ambassador. She's been eyeing him all evening, so he hasn't had the chance to put up his Rodney-specific barriers, and he's actually pretty tipsy besides. Colonel. Okay. Rodney comes to lean his elbows on the railing next to John, and John deliberately doesn't look over. It's really about the only thing he can do now to delay the inevitable. You know, says Rodney conversationally, I don't really understand you at all. And Rodney isn't drunk enough to not know what he's doing. He's not drunk enough to say whatever he's thinking, because he does that anyway. But he is drunk enough to ask questions he knows he's not supposed to ask, questions he probably won't like the answers to. Specifically, what is it you want, Shepherd? And now John swings his head to look at Rodney. He's a little flushed, the top two buttons of his shirt open. And John thinks, I want that. I want Atlantis safe from the Wraith, and while we're at it, the whole Pegasus galaxy. I want Elizabeth to be able to sleep through the night. I want Taylor to have a family. I want Ronan to have a home. I want Lieutenant James Felty, 24 years old, Company C, known to his friends as Shortstop, from Hereford, PA, not to have died last week on QCL-396. I want the Genii to stop fucking with us, and I want someone else to do this shitty job. John thinks about it for a minute, and then he decides, what the hell. It's non-denominational winter holiday. This is his non-denominational winter holiday present to himself. He lets his mouth tip up into what he knows is a mischievous grin. I want to dance, he says. Rodney looks uncomprehending for a second, then intensely irritated. Right, he said. Clearly you have come out here because you wanted to dance. Look, Colonel, would it kill you to be serious for once? You don't need to, you know, give me that actor movie routine. I thought we were friends. And that almost stops him, because Rodney is his friend, maybe the best one he has here. And if he keeps fucking around like this, he doesn't know how much longer that's going to last. But John's not going to stop, at least not right now. Because whatever people might think about him, he's never really been very good at the whole self-control thing. Just because you don't like the answer, Rodney, doesn't mean I'm not serious. And he lets the truth of it bleed through a little. You want to dance out here? Rodney crosses his arms over his chest. With me? John nods, takes a step closer. Rodney keeps glaring at him. Come on, Rodney, just one dance, he wheedles. After all, it's Christmas. And Rodney tilts his chin up like he's going to keep fighting, but he slowly lowers his arms to his sides. And that's all the invitation John needs. He presses in close, his hand on Rodney's waist. They're playing something that sounds to John like Spanish ballroom music, and Rodney lets him just sway them to the beat. He's practically got his cheek resting against Rodney's neck, and it feels good. It feels really, really nice. It's a relief, really. This is all he needs, just this much. And then he can go back to the way things were before. Forget about it for a while. And it's good to know he's not so far out of line that he won't be able to find his way back. And it's all just good. And then Rodney huffs indignantly. Clearly you have no conception whatsoever of how to lead, which really isn't much of a surprise, given your abysmal navigational skills. And he manhandles John until he's got one hand at John's lower back, the other holding John's right hand out to the side. This is the tango, he says. And suddenly Rodney's leg is wedged in tight between John's, and he's forcing him back,
swivelling his hips at the same time. John stumbles at first, but Rodney steadies him with a hand at his back, and he falls pretty quickly into the rhythm of the sliding half-steps. And then Rodney picks up the pace, turning John, then spinning him in a tight curl that presses him against Rodney's chest, wrapping one leg high up around John's thigh for a second, then pulling John all the way against him, hips to chest, right before he shoves forward, and Christ, he's actually dipping John. And it would be kind of awkward and ridiculous, but it's not. Not at all. And the whole thing has John so turned on that there's no way Rodney won't be able to tell as soon as he pulls John back up and in. Oh. Rodney releases his hold. And John would definitely take that as his cue to leave, but Rodney's between him and the door. Rodney's flushed and glistening with sweat, which isn't really helping John's condition any. But he's not moving, looking a little down and away as he says in a rush, "Look, I've been thinking. There really aren't that many opportunities to meet people here. I mean, people who don't work for you or aren't, you know, industrial spies or beings from another astral plane. And it seems like we could... I mean, clearly we could both use... And we have a certain amount of experience with this already, which worked out okay. And maybe..." Rodney waves a hand frantically between them. "Maybe we could help each other out?" It takes John a good 5 seconds to work out what Rodney's saying. And God, Rodney really has been working for the military too long if he's picked up stuff like "help each other out." And the whole thing would almost be hilariously funny, except for the fact it would tear John up into tiny pieces, blur the line so badly he'd never find it again. And you can't be subtle with Rodney. Subtle doesn't take. So he says, low and mean, "Help each other out. What, like this?" And he grabs Rodney's head, pressing his fingers in hard to the base of his skull, and lays on the wettest, lewdest kiss he can manage, biting at Rodney's lips, fucking his tongue into Rodney's mouth, sucking on Rodney's tongue. And when he pulls back, Rodney's frozen and staring, gasping for breath, his lips red and swollen. "Yeah, I didn't think so," John says, his brief feeling of vindication swamped by a sudden rush of nausea, and he pushes past Rodney, back into the blaring party, into the empty corridor, to his dark room, where he thinks the door closed with extreme conviction and tells Atlantis not to let anyone bother him unless it's a code red emergency. John was prepared for Rodney to avoid him for the next few days, a period of awkwardness that they would eventually work through. He was not prepared for Rodney to show up at his quarters the very next evening, already talking as he walked through the door. "Listen, Colonel, I think we need to talk. About last night." John's got nothing. He was basically counting on universal principles of social conditioning and public embarrassment, but he should have known they didn't apply to McKay. And now he's hesitated too long, and Rodney's taken the opportunity to barrel ahead. "Didn't make myself clear. I mean, enthusiasm on your part is not really a problem, and given our circumstances and our shared history, I still think it's an ideal..." "Rodney, we can't talk about this." "Yes, yes, of course. I think you'll find I can be discreet. The need for..." "No! I can't talk about this. I can't talk to you about this. I can't do this." God, this is new heights of obtuseness, even for Rodney. If he doesn't get out of this conversation soon, he feels like his skin might burst right open, scattering pieces of Lieutenant Colonel John Shepherd all over the floor. "I don't understand." "God damn it, Rodney, you have to stop. The answer is no." And that raises McKay's hackles, thank God. And John expects a scathing retort. But what Rodney says is, "I have to stop? Well, that's rich, coming from the king of the mixed message. I swear, every time I turn round, you're looking at me like... I don't know what, and then..." John feels like he's been sucker-punched. It's true. He's been following the rules and then rewarding himself by breaking them for weeks now. But he never thought Rodney would notice. He never thought Rodney knew. "Oh, God. You're right, I'm sorry," he croaks out. "Rodney, God, I'll try to do better." And he must look as bad as he feels, because Rodney's own face is a mirror of shock and dismay. "John, what?" he tries tentatively. But that's the absolute last thing he can take. "I can't," he rasps one more time, and flees his own quarters, pushing past Rodney into the hall, to the nearest transporter, where he doesn't bother selecting a destination, just tells Atlantis to take him somewhere far away. They're down to critical systems, trying to eke out a little more time from their rapidly depleting power sources. For once,
They've got enough proteins, sufficient leafy greens, a seemingly inexhaustible supply of Tarat fruit. The infirmary is stocked with analgesics, composite surgical thread and sterile gauze-like pads. The armory is bristling with small and large arms, stocked to the ceiling and into four adjoining rooms with crates of ammunition. It's the only thing John orders anymore on the infrequent Daedalus resupply runs. And if he's uneasy about the feeling that he's gearing up for some kind of full-scale galactic war, the fear of being caught short is worse. But none of that matters if they lose the ability to power and shield the city. All but the nerve centre transporters are offline, and John collects another bruise as he misjudges the corner in the murky stairwell near his quarters. If he's quiet and concentrates, he can still hear Atlantis thrumming in the walls and floors, but she's muted and distant, doesn't recognise him, isn't quite herself. And John is afraid, because this machine, this simple union of energy and conduit, hardware and software, it's not enough. There's no way it can keep them safe. The Upter have a gallery of valuable objects, a couple of pieces of modern sculpture, a small hill of Tingan black salt, an intricately woven Pilat tapestry in the style of Fanatha, a carefully arranged sunburst of cracked control crystals and, on a low pedestal in a far corner, an amber and gold zero-point module.
Oh my God, it's fully charged! Rodney tries to whisper, but it comes out as a hoarse shout, and John wants to snap at him when he sees the calculating gleam in their Upter host's eyes, but it's not really fair to pin this one on McKay's utter lack of guile. John can feel himself leaning in, while Ronan looks ready to grab and run, and even Taylor casts her eyes in precisely the opposite direction and licks her lips.
"We will not trade for it," says Miloth. "But you can earn it."
Those are, quite possibly, some of the most ominous words in the Pegasus Galaxy. But John doesn't care. They never had any leverage in this negotiation anyway, and he's ready to go. Run the course, climb the mountain, jump the fire, chant the prayers, recite the first 105 digits of pi, whatever they want.
It doesn't start to seem like a bad decision until much later. What John thinks instead, as the heavy leather lash comes down on his back again, slicing obliquely through an already opened welt of ruptured skin, is that he's totally going to make it. He's channeling the zeal of the reality TV contestant. And if he's lost a little perspective, it's only bound to improve his odds. The bug eating was a walk in the park, the crunch of their brittle exoskeletons actually somewhat satisfying. Answering the mystic riddles of Upat Creedon was a snap when he could crib just by asking the ancient designed library database nicely. He demonstrated and conveyed knowledge by convincingly proving the Pythagorean theorem to a hyperactive gaggle of 10-year-olds. The ICAT poisoning was less pleasant, but he sweated through it after 5 hours, and the 17 lashes were painful but bearable. He slips in under the wire with the sewing of the 52 rows of Simat, stumbling to his knees at the end of the last furrow, the pink and gold gleam of Apat's twin suns just gilding the horizon. Apparently it's time for the next challenge already, because two burly attendants in matching vests grab him under each arm, haul him to his feet and hustle him a few yards to thrust him into what seems at first to be a closet and turns out to be a box, which they shut and lock, leaving John in utter darkness. He starts to cramp up after 40 minutes. There's no way to move or stretch, and the sweat from working the fields is drying, leaving him cold and stiff. A muscle spasm starts in his left thigh, jumping erratically under his hand every few minutes. And it's getting harder, sure, but he's got his eyes on the prize. With a fully charged ZPM, they could bring systems online that they don't even know about yet. With a fully charged ZPM, they have an early warning system again, a buffer to take the critical edge off every mission. With a fully charged ZPM, he can buy a little breathing room for the Marines, who are wearing down, for the scientists, who don't sleep enough. A fully charged ZPM will give Elizabeth a chance to regroup. It will give McKay his opportunity to pull off the big miracle they all need. It will give them a chance. For the next hour and a half, that's what he does. He thinks about what a fully charged ZPM means. Lights in non-essential areas. Movie nights. The thrum of Atlantis under his hand. Unrestricted showers. Recreational jumper use. Access to unexplored sectors of the city. New ancient tech. DJ dance parties. Dancing. Dancing with McKay. When they pull him out, the light from the lamps is a sudden and searing pain, bringing immediate tears to his eyes. It's too bright where the lights are, and too dark where they're not, for him to really make out anything at all. He just registers multiple sets of hands, lifting and tugging, and removing all his clothes. which he would object to more if they weren't filthy and sweaty and stiff, and if he hadn't spent the last 3-odd hours locked up with them inside a coffin-sized box. Once it stops being a scalding shock, the steam bath is quite possibly the best thing he's ever experienced. They leave him until he's barely conscious, a pliant noodle. He's given something warm and spicy to drink. He's given a pair of loose-fitting pants that hang off the edges of his hips. He's led to a room smoky with incense, where they paint him with black lines and circles, on his chest, his back, his arms. Once he enters the circle of torches, John starts to return to alertness. There was probably a stimulant in that drink they gave him, and something else, too, something that gives the torchlight a sparking halo that paints vivid colours over the press of half-naked bodies stretching into the dark. This is clearly the grand finale, and John feels poised. He feels like he has a shot. He feels willfully optimistic, eyeing the guy on the other side of the ring. Right up until the innermost circle of observers turns and draws down masks of white powdered clay over their faces, trailing lengths of snarled yarn, beads and leaves and scraps of bone, like hair, a caricature at least as sinister and vastly more unnerving than the predators it's designed to imitate. The contents of John's stomach try to convulse their way up his esophagus, but he fights it down as he reassesses the stakes, which have just gone up, and his chances, which have just gone way, way down, as he automatically starts circling his opponent at the banging of a gong, which clearly signals the start of the first round. The other guy is well-muscled and he's moving too easily. It's likely that he didn't recently spend 3 hours locked in a box, and the 7 before that planting 52 motherfucking rows of lentil-sized seeds. He faints to the left, but John doesn't even acknowledge it. It's a sloppy move, which means the guy's cocky. And John can use that to his advantage. It isn't much of a stretch, but a bit of a drag into his left leg, telegraph his stiff muscles. He mirrors the guy around the ring for a while, trying to do a threat assessment on the gathered crowd. There isn't really much point. He can't see much beyond the nearest smoking torches, but he can tell there's a lot of people out there. And it's not like he'd make it beyond the first ring of wraith lookalikes anyway, each armed with a metal-ringed wooden staff. His opponent lunges and John sidesteps, bringing up his knee as hard as he can into the guy's ribs. He starts out with the element of surprise, but the guy recovers enough to throw himself sideways away from the blow. He'll have a nasty bruise, but nothing's broken. And that's it, right there. The guy reassesses him from across the ring. He won't fall for that twice. They both know he's stronger than John, and they both know he's going to win. And John hates losing. He really hates losing. He especially hates losing to wraith-worshipping arseholes who string him along for 15 hours of party games with no intention of ever handing over their untouched, mint-condition, never-been-out-of-the-box EPM. So he's going to lose, but he's sure as hell going to make this guy work for it. And he launches himself across the ring, slamming his foot into the guy's right knee. He gets an elbow to the face that sends him reeling back, but he grins around the taste of blood in his mouth, because when Muscle Guy stands back up, his leg won't straighten quite right. And then it's a headbutt to the abdomen, followed by a throw to the ground that knocks the wind out of him. John gets in a kick to the groin that gives him a couple seconds to catch his breath, but now the guy seems pissed. And he comes up swinging, landing a couple of body blows and an uppercut John just manages to twist into a graze off his cheekbone. He keeps turning into the punch, capturing the fist in both hands and wrenching it round as he ducks out from under it, until there's a satisfying popping sound. By round 6, they're both moving pretty slowly around the ring. The fingers on John's right hand are swelling up. His left eye feels like it's being slowly forced closed. His left shoulder is rasping painfully in its socket, and two of the welts on his back have opened up again. He can feel the blood trickling steadily down his back. But the other guy's got a leg that won't straighten all the way, at least one broken finger, a bruised rib, and a nasty-looking bite mark on his upper arm. The torches won't resolve anymore. They're like smearing across John's field of vision in a kind of luminescent smog. The wooden staffs thud twice into the packed earth. The gong sounds. John's opponent has got him bigger, his skin radiating beyond its normal limits, and when he punches John in the face, he has far too many teeth. The wooden staffs beat twice. The gong sounds. The circle's gotten smaller. John's stumbling so close to the edge he can smell the vivid blue off the nearest bodies. He lunges away again, until he's caught from behind in some kind of grappling hold. John kicks back, again and again, into the injured knee until the man with lots of teeth staggers and lets him go. Which turns out to be an empty victory since the sudden loss of counterbalancing weight immediately sends John to his knees. His left arm buckles when he tries to push himself up and he falls on his face in the dirt, rolling onto his back to try and catch his breath. There's something wrong with his chest, preventing him from getting enough air. The red is spreading, mixing with the blues from the edge of the circle, and when he looks up, his death is coming for him, wearing a white clay mask. Fuck you and your fucking excessive realism, he thinks, and as the hand reaches for his chest, John throws his head back to look up at the night sky instead. Which is when Jumper 4 decloaks directly above the crowd, hatch opening in mid-air. There's a noise like thunder and a light like salvation. Ronan, Taylor, Rodney with his arm raised above his head, holding what looks like a remote detonator, the three of them flanking Elizabeth, who is standing on the edge of the ramp in black BDUs, purple flames at the ends of her hair, silver streamers curling out of her mouth. Without any rotor backwash, they are even more uncanny, an unperturbed tableau. Angels of Wrath come to take him home. John spends 6 days in the infirmary. Dislocated shoulder, broken fingers, scratched cornea, infected lacerations, bruised ribs. When he wakes up the first time, the infirmary's dark. The only thing he can see is McKay's face floating by the bed, bathed in monitor blue. "Too bad about the ZPM, huh?" he manages to croak out, jolting Rodney upright from his slouch. "Are you kidding?" he hisses back, leaning over to stare into John's good eye. "We got you, and then we got the ZPM. It turns out Elizabeth's prime directives don't apply to criminally deranged, wraith-worshipping arseholes. Thank Christ." The sudden and overwhelming relief is better than the pseudo-morphine drip. "If we have a fully charged ZPM, then what are you doing here, McKay?" Rodney waves a hand dismissively. "I'm letting Raddick have his 5 minutes." John feels a smile starting at the corner of his mouth, echoed back on Rodney's face, creating some kind of feedback loop until they're both grinning like loons. "Oh, God," John gasps. "Thank God." And just like that, his euphoria tips over into desperate sorrow. He's suddenly on the verge of tears, quickly turning his head away from McKay, into the pillow, gasping in shaky breaths. "You should sleep," says Rodney after a minute. Everything's okay right now. You should get some more sleep." "Don't go," thinks John. He reaches out blindly with his left hand until he finds Rodney's, and Rodney just sits back down and lets John hold his hand, tight and sweaty, until he slips back under into dreams. He doesn't see Rodney again for 8.5 days, and when he stumbles into the 9 a.m. senior staff meeting, it looks like he hasn't slept in that long either. Or showered. "Can you give us a progress report, Rodney?" Elizabeth asks. And Rodney pops up from behind his laptop to say brightly, "Well, we didn't have anything better to do this week, so we thought we'd hook up our new, fully charged, physically improbable, massive quantum energy source." It's not even sarcasm. It misses sarcasm by about a mile. Elizabeth's mouth quirks up and Carson's just full on grinning. Rodney rests his chin on his steepled fingers. "We've got new sensors online, long-range, short-range, mid-range, biological, structural, algorithmic, infrared, ultraviolet, microwave, molecular, barometric, volumetric, bionic. Our sensors have sensors, which probably also have sensors. If a tree falls in the forest on any planet on the galaxy, there's probably a sensor somewhere in Atlantis that knows about it. Of course, most of that is wildly unnecessary, but what it does tell us is exactly where the structural damage is and how safe or unsafe the unexplored sections of the city are. We now have error-free wraith detection, early warning for biological and nanotechnological agents, and a handy name tag system for keeping track of all the Atlantis personnel. Since laws of probability dictate that any intruders who are not wraith, alien smallpox, or self-replicating miniature robots will be Genii agents, spies, or collaborators, I've taken the liberty of coding those life signs to display as jackbooted warmongering moron." Rodney's practically punch drunk. Everyone in the room is enjoying the show, and John's no exception. "We've got automatic resource allocation, which means the city can manage its own energy sharing, improving efficiency by 2.7%. 60% of our systems are now rechargeable, and never has the saying, 'Nothing succeeds like success,' or 'The rich get richer,' been truer. Having more energy allows us to make more energy, or, to be strictly accurate, to save more energy. The puddle jumpers, for example, they slice, they dice, they double as really big fuel cells, converting kinetic energy every time you fly them. Plug them into central energy conversion and hey presto, practically continuous shield generation. So go ahead, Colonel, joyride whenever you want." The smile Rodney turns his way is vaguely dreamy, and it sends a hot rush of pleasure straight to John's groin.
It turns out, continues Rodney, swivelling back to address Elizabeth, that the city of Atlantis is completely modular, capable of splitting into 8 separate, autonomous, fully operational, life-supporting, floating, submerging, flying units. Of course, there's only one Stargate, but there are 7 other control rooms with remote control capability. As you all know, we depleted the entire arsenal of weapon drones during our last brush with soul-sucking annihilation, but, and here Rodney leans forward and lowers his voice, I'm going to tell you a secret. His eyes dart around the room, and his grin is more than a little manic.
What's the secret, Rodney? Elizabeth asks gamely.
The secret, Rodney announces delightedly, is that we can make more! Replication and construction sites with prefab templates have been located in sectors 6.B and 5C and D. We've already run preliminary diagnostics and there should...
Rodney, Elizabeth interrupts,
that's wonderful news.
Oh God, thinks John, oh God. He wants to jump up and down, grab Rodney and dance him round the room, go for one of those battery charging joyrides. He settles for throwing an arm over the back of his chair and smiling lazily.
Not bad, McKay.
Rodney doesn't even call him on it.
Yes, yes, not bad indeed. The ancients have a very interesting take on mechanical engineering, you know. From what I can tell, there's a self-organising principle.
And John could stay here all day, with Rodney staring into his eyes, earnestly explaining the way the ancients used crude distributed AI to make the marvels of engineering that will let him blow the Wraith into tiny, tiny pieces. But Elizabeth is making wrap up the meeting noises, and Carson is stepping in to say he wants Rodney to take the next 12 hours off, rehydrate, get some sleep.
Yes, yes, I'll sleep later, Rodney waves him off.
But Carson has plenty of experience dealing with Dr. Rodney McKay.
You'll sleep now, Rodney. None of these discoveries are going anywhere. I'll get you a military escort if I have to.
Rodney's expression of dismay is comical in its intensity. It reminds John of the time he was barred from baseball practice because of unfinished chores when he was 9.
But Carson, I have to go back. You don't understand. Zelenka's vicious. He won't wait for me. He'll get to see it first and I won't get the chance to figure it out before he tells me all about it.
I'm sending Radic to bed too. You can go back to work together after you've both gotten some sleep.
Are you crazy? You can't have us both off duty at once. The city will implode or something. We'll all die horribly.
Rodney, Elizabeth intercedes. I'm sure we can handle things for a few hours. If something goes wrong and we need your help, we'll wake you. But unless and until that happens, you're off duty. She puts the note of command into it, and Rodney lapses into a slumped ball of defeat. Come on, says John, elbowing him in the ribs. I'll walk you back. I'm perfectly fine, McKay grumbles as he misjudges the distance and ricochets off the edge of the doorway.
Right, says John, grabbing his elbow and steering him down the hallway.
You're going to sleep, right? Says John, at the door to Rodney's quarters.
Yes, I'm going to sleep, Rodney snaps, as he stumbles over to his bed, clutching his laptop to his chest. Okay, well, you won't need this then.
And John reaches in and snatches the laptop, dancing quickly out of range. Rodney stares down at his empty hands for a moment, and when he looks back up, his eyes are sad and lost.
John, he whispers, you have to promise me something.
And John's heart lurches in his chest. He thought Rodney had taken pity on him. He thought Rodney was going to let it go. He can't do this. He's not allowed. But God, if he could, he would promise Rodney anything, anything he wanted, anything he asked.
You have to promise me you'll make sure Zelenka leaves the lab. You have to personally go and make sure. Follow him to his quarters, please.
John lets out his held breath in a hiccuping laugh. I promise, he says. And with a sigh of relief, Rodney face plants into the pillows and is out like a light. Rodney gets almost 9 hours sleep before they have to wake him, which is probably a new Atlantis record for him. But somehow the thought isn't much consolation to John as he pounds down the corridor, trying to buckle his sidearm to the leg of his sweatpants as he runs to the scene of the storm cloud attached to their most recent silver lining.
I'm going to kill Van Buren.
It's the kind of threat Rodney makes about 6 times a day, but he seems to mean it a little more than usual.
What's the situation? John demands as he skids into the gate room.
Oh, Colonel, you're going to love this.
This is classic Pegasus Galaxy slapstick comedy. Dr. Van Buren,
and of course I use that appellation in the loosest possible sense, decided, in his infinite wisdom, that he would take it upon himself to test the remote dialing capabilities of the Control Room 6. This despite the fact that he had neither authorization, permission, nor, clearly, the rudimentary intelligence needed to carry out such a task.
Rodney pauses for breath, a red flush of fury creeping down the neck of his grey t-shirt, which reads, "Gravity. It's not just a good idea, it's the law." Gone is the giddy enthusiasm of 9 hours ago, but, John has to admit ruefully, he likes this version of Rodney even more.
In a reasonable universe, this act of immense incompetence would have resulted in nothing more than the ancient equivalent of a blown fuse, but because God plays loaded dice in this one, we've managed to hit 3 cherries all in a row. 1, a failure of central control to override remote commands. 2, because the Stargate was actually activated at the time, an unstable looping branch created within the engaged wormhole. And 3, because SGA-2 was actually en route through the wormhole at the exact time of the remote command, 4 expedition members stuck inside that looping branch.
Lorne, Cadman, Parrish and Buchanan are in there somewhere. John's going to kill Van Buren. We have 38 minutes before we lose waveform integrity. Colonel, start the clock.
John does, and is pathetically grateful to have been given a job.
Apparently, SGA-2 is sort of halfway between Atlantis and PZG-143, where Van Buren dialed. Except not really. It's more like half of them is all the way to Atlantis, and the other half of them going to the Alpha site. Except that's not it either. It's more like half their probability mass. And that's just about where John's intellectual curiosity hits the wall.
Rodney gets 2 Marines to remove the entire front panel of the DHD console, and then he just dives right into the messy innards. The room falls completely silent, so they can all hear with stunning clarity each time Rodney barks for a tool from Kusanagi and his high-volume radio consultations with Zelenka in Control Room 6, which sound a lot to John like slight variations on, "No, that won't work. Wait, check it now. Is there a bypass? No, damn it, try it again."
22 minutes, he says to Rodney's legs. Rodney twitches, then goes silent for a minute.
"Okay, here's what we're going to do," he says, low and intense into the radio. And John can't really follow the rest, but he can hear Zelenka's bellowing right through the line. "I'm perfectly well aware of that, but we don't have the time."
And Rodney's holding his hand out, snapping impatiently, and Kusanagi somehow knows to put a green crystal into it. At 19 minutes, Simpson and Zelenka show up with a Naquada generator they attach directly to the Stargate. At 15 minutes, they clear the gate room of all non-essential personnel, which clearly doesn't include John, because he's the goddamn timekeeping device. At 10 minutes, Rodney crawls out from under the console, his t-shirt dark with sweat and clinging to his shoulders and upper back.
"Do it!" he yells, and Simpson flips the switch. The generator sends a pulse to the gate, which jolts, the wormhole pulsing and flickering from blue to green to yellow. For a heart-stopping moment, it looks like the gate's empty, the weak signal snuffing out. And then the billowing whoosh as the blue wave rebounds into the room. 3 crystals blow on the console, like flashbulbs going off, and SGA-2 walks through the gate, looking slightly bewildered at their reception. John doesn't think about it. He just grabs Rodney by the back of the neck and kisses him hard on the mouth. And then all the sound rushes back into the room. There are cheers and yells. A medical team swarms the gate.
I need to take a shower, says Rodney. And then he's gone.
John takes his own shower, cold and brutally efficient. Rodney's eyes, his shoulders, the back of his neck, his hands, flashing through his mind's eye in quick succession. He doesn't jerk off, because he's let this thing go too far, and he needs to start exerting some control, pull himself together. He can't afford to fuck up his military command, he can't afford to fuck up his team, and his ability to make objective decisions in the field, and he can't afford to fuck up his friendship with Rodney. God, he doesn't even know when he started to develop a taste for straight guys with bad table manners, and broad shoulders, and crooked mouths, and deft hands. He's in bed when the door chimes, and before he can ask who it is, Rodney's already barreling into the room. Jesus, it's deja vu all over again.
"Look, Rodney, I'm sorry," he says, slowly getting to his feet.
No, Rodney's shaking his head briskly, a finger in John's face. "You,
And Rodney punctuates this by poking him in the chest. No longer get a vote. And then he's wrapping a hand round the back of John's neck and kissing him. Kissing him like he means it. Lips and tongue and a little bit of teeth. Wet and hot and electric. And lasting for 7 days. When he finally pulls back, John gasps and stutters and makes a last gasp at control of the situation. Rodney, we both know it doesn't work that way. You can't just... No more vote, says Rodney, pushing him up against the wall with a hand to his chest. And then, sweet Jesus, he's dropping to his knees, taking John's boxers with him. And John doesn't expect it to be any good, but it doesn't matter. A mouth on his cock is kind of the most amazing thing ever at this point. But God almighty, Rodney McKay is giving him possibly the best blowjob he's ever received. And John has a moment to be briefly annoyed that Rodney has to be such a prodigy at every damn thing before he's coming, tipped over the edge and falling forever. When he comes back to himself, he's seized with a new kind of conviction. And if they're going to do this, then they're going to do it right. Rodney's still on his knees, licking his lips with an air of intense concentration. John hauls him to his feet and manhandles him to the bed, where he strips them efficiently of the rest of their clothing. Is this what you want? He asks, as he slowly grinds the entire length of his naked body against Rodney's, grasping his forearms and pinning them above his head. Yes, Jesus, finally, Rodney groans, but John brushes his hip against Rodney's cock. Grinning, John dips his head to take Rodney's earlobe between his teeth, blowing hot, moist air down Rodney's neck, which obligingly breaks out into goosebumps. He licks his way down to the collarbone and takes the time to suck hard at the skin right above the bone, causing Rodney to curse and arch off the bed. Then he's skimming his hands over Rodney's chest, circling both nipples with his thumbs until they're hard and flushed dark pink, pressing his fingers to each rib, licking a broad trail down to Rodney's belly button. John spreads Rodney's legs, pressing his face against his inner thigh, kissing and breathing and sucking until Rodney's writhing and yelling at him, and red all the way from his ears down to the middle of his chest. And then John slides up Rodney's body again, wrapping one hand around Rodney's cock and the other around the back of Rodney's head, because he wants to watch. He wants to watch Rodney when he comes, and it's just like he remembers it. Are you sure that's the first time you've ever done that? He asks Rodney later when they're lying in bed. And Rodney flushes and looks away. I may have been practicing with the tarat fruit. The tarat fruit? And John starts laughing, and he can't stop, snorting and wheezing as Rodney hits him repeatedly with a pillow, laughing and laughing until he's crying, grabbing Rodney hard around the middle, jamming his face into Rodney's neck, laughing and crying, crying and hiccuping, until he gasps to a stop. He wants to apologise for the wet spot on Rodney's neck and his new and disturbing tendency towards hysteria, but when he tries to move, Rodney just tightens his hold, pressing John closer with a strong hand to the back of his head, another between his shoulder blades. And John doesn't fight, because this is where he wants to be. The end.